Hi, this is Smriti Kirvanandan, your host for Health Forward Podcast. One of the most important things you can do for yourself is to take care of your health. Your road to discovering an all-inclusive, empathetic, and innovative healthcare ecosystem starts right now. Before we dive into the episode, I would like to share that Health Forward is an independent entity and does not represent any organization I work with or I do not work with. I know I can't save all my clients, and I've learned that every case is a profound failure until I succeed. Join us in a compelling conversation with Jared Kenser, a distinguished human rights lawyer, as we delve into the very essence of a shared humanity. In this episode, we explore the critical intersection of human rights, freedom, and an often overlooked yet deeply interconnected facet of our lives, healthcare. Genser's insights shed light on the profound impact human rights issues have on the accessibility and quality of healthcare around the world. Prepared to be inspired and challenged as we navigate the intricate parts of justice, liberty, and the universal right to health. This interview promises to be a thought-provoking exploration of the unbreakable bonds between human rights advocacy and the well-being of individuals globally. Jared, welcome to Health Forward. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
The Miracle Man, the Extractor, Freedom is His Business are some of the names you're known by. Jared, I've read about your illness when you experienced a coma and your journey to a world-renowned lawyer. I would love to hear this story, this journey from you, firsthand from you.
Well, that can cover a lot of ground, and I'm more than happy to talk about different parts of it. One of the things that's probably of some interest to your listeners is that when I was a kid, I had Reye syndrome, which was something that people would get, kind of mysteriously popped up in kids that had the flu and had been given aspirin. And so I was in a coma for a relatively brief period of time and survived that illness when I was 10 years old. And only kind of later came to realize the impact that had had on me. You know, when I was getting sick, you know, it presented itself with flu-like symptoms. And then I became, you know, much more comatose before I fell asleep into a coma. But I remember coming downstairs with my little suitcase at the age of 10 and my mom being very, very upset. And I remember arriving at the hospital. And so the next thing I recall was waking up there, obviously, a couple of days later. Back then, there was no, and today, there's really no treatment for it other than to let it ride its course. And it attacks the liver and can cause the brain to swell. For people with more extreme versions of the disease who end up dying, it's because of brain swelling. In my case, luckily, I didn't have a serious version of it. And I survived somehow. It was just sort of meant to be, I guess you could say. And later on, I ended up being a hospice volunteer in high school, which is an unusual thing for a kid to do. And as I went through the training for hospice, I came to realize that the reason why I was interested in hospice was because of my prior illness and not feeling in any way like I was, you know, free from the possibility of dying. I've never felt invincible or indestructible, but I do remember it being a very peaceful experience going into the coma and coming out of the coma and not a scary one. Again, maybe it's because of my age and because, you know, I probably wasn't told all the details of what was going on, but ultimately it was a positive experience for me coming out of that. And it made me want to help others to the extent that I could. So, you know, I was very involved in community service and public service work in middle school and high school, and kind of went on to college and law school after that. I've always been involved in public service work, but in some ways it does tie back to that original illness that I had and my recovery from it.
So, you know, it's really fascinating, Jared. I've learned quite a bit about you and the work you're doing, and you're really passionate about human rights. And to me, you know, working in healthcare, I think no matter what we talk about, whether that's accessibility, affordability, freedom of rights of speech, it all comes to dignity. But what really inspired you specifically to go full force into this?
Yeah, I mean, both my parents were involved in public service themselves. I mean, my mom is a clinical social worker. My father was in the U.S. Public Health Service for 30 years as a physician and researcher. So public service is kind of always part of who I was. This also tied back to my own family background. Most of my family came to the United States at the turn of the 20th century, fleeing anti-Jewish persecution in Eastern Europe and modern day Belarus, Latvia, and Poland. And so I was always taught that, you know, I was very lucky to be an American and that I had an obligation to give back to my community wherever I possibly could. And that's how my parents raised me. In college, you know, I was focusing on domestic public service work. And when I went to graduate school in public policy, at the Kennedy School of Government, I was also focusing on domestic public service work. I thought I was going to go maybe work in government, work in the U.S. government in some kind of, you know, either healthcare or criminal justice space. And then it was announced that the then Chinese president, Jiang Zemin, was going to come and visit our campus. This was in the fall of 1997. And that didn't in and of itself bother me. I mean, I thought it was fine for him to come and speak. But we then learned that, you know, he wasn't going to take any questions and no protesters would be allowed on campus. And this was, of course, Harvard University. And I thought that was highly inconsistent with the spirit of what the university should be about. And so I got involved in helping to organize the protests against Jiang Zemin and met a lot of extraordinary human rights defenders who were Harvard students at the time. One of them, Lobsang Sangye, was the first Tibetan getting his PhD at Harvard Law School. He later became the prime minister in exile of Tibet. I met another extraordinary dissident, a guy named Yang Zhenli, who had been in Tiananmen Square in 89 and had witnessed what had happened. And then became a blacklisted dissident. And he was one of the organizers as well. You know, we organized this protest, which actually turned out the largest protest at Harvard since the Vietnam War. And when it was over, I was like, well, what impact did this actually have on human rights in China? And my conclusion was, you know, none at all, because obviously the cameras were pointing in a different direction. But I also have been really inspired by these extraordinary human rights defenders who I'd met and was kind of like, you know, thinking to myself, well, gosh, if I could do something to help people like this in the countries that they're actually from and in, that could be a really compelling piece of life's work. And so this is how I kind of decided to go to law school to study to become a human rights lawyer and how I ended up at the University of Michigan Law School. You know, my application essay was, here's why I want to become a human rights lawyer. And in fact, ultimately, you know, that's what I did. You know, after one's first year in law school, where everyone takes about the same classes, you know, all of my studies after my first year were focusing on public international law issues of all different kinds, not just human rights, but, you know, to understand the way the international legal system works. And I had an experience as a law student, you know, freeing my first political prisoner, which was really empowering for me. I was in London for a semester, second semester of my second year of law school, working at a human rights NGO called the AIR Center, which primarily focused on taking cases to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. But I read on the tube ride home one day about this British guy named James Maudsley, who had gotten a 17-year sentence in solitary confinement in Burma for handing out pro-democracy leaflets. And I asked my boss if we could get involved in the case. And she said, sure, reach out to his family. And although I was a law student, they didn't have a lawyer helping them. They did have a Burmese lawyer, but that wouldn't have been of much help because this was a brutal authoritarian regime and there was no independent and impartial judiciary. And, you know, with a little help and inspiration, you know, I tripped through the process of getting him out. I took his case to this little known body at the UN called the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention that looks at these kinds of individual cases and determines whether or not a person is being held illegally after trying to get any information it can from the government. I came back to Washington the summer after I'd been in London. I was able to get a group of members of Congress involved. You know, we had 5 senators and 18 members of Congress write to the Burmese regime about the case. And I'd also gotten a bunch of British parliamentarians involved, as well as the British Foreign Office, of course, because he was British. And in the fall of my third year of law school, I was back in my law school dorm room when I got the phone call that he was about to be released and was, you know, shocked at how it had worked and come together. You know, I was there when he arrived. I had a plane a moment later and was there when he arrived after 416 days in solitary confinement and was there, you know, in the VIP lounge off the runway when he was reunited with his family. You know, it had been a huge news story in the UK, the first story on every major news broadcast. You know, I'd been with other supporters of his the night before his arrival, watching him land in Bangkok on the front end of all the news broadcasts. And of course, you know, when he landed in London 12 hours later, he was, of course, wearing the same clothes. And I just watched from a distance as his family was reunited with him. And his mom then introduced him to me and said, James, this is Jared. And he gave me a firm handshake and a smile and said, thanks, you saved my life. As for someone who is not often speechless, I was in this moment. And what was so impressive was that, you know, we then did a press conference. This was like early on a Saturday morning on a bitter cold day. I remember like it was yesterday in October of the year 2000. Saturday, the 20th of October. And we did a press conference with journalists. And even despite the early time of day and the fact that it was at Heathrow Airport, you know, we had like 15 or 20 journalists present, plus, you know, probably 10 TV cameras. And he gave a press conference like he'd been thinking about it the entire time he was in jail, saying, this isn't about me. You know, well, I'm happy to be free. I went to jail for the 1,200 Burmese political prisoners and the world needs to pay attention to them and what they're going through and what they're suffering. Right. And of course, you know, sitting there, you know, in that room as we conducted this press conference and reflecting on what had happened, I was just kind of overwhelmed. I couldn't believe that it had actually succeeded. And in thinking back, you know, afterwards, in the coming months after that, as I was finishing up my time in law school, I was you know, I was like, you know, wow, this was, you know, an extraordinary experience. And the question was, could the formula that I kind of had stumbled upon, combining legal, political, and public relations advocacy, could that work to get a Burmese person out of a Burmese prison, or a Pakistani out of a Pakistani prison, or a Chinese person out of a Chinese prison, and so forth, right? And I was determined to see how that might be possible. And so after graduating from law school, I talked to a lot of human rights groups that work in the space of, you know, advancing human rights, but none of the major human rights groups in the world actually represent the political prisoners directly for their families in a lawyer advocacy model. And that was a distinguishing feature of my work, because even though I wasn't yet a lawyer, I was his representative. And I was able to say, this is what the family would like to do next. And I was able to mobilize people to get support in support of what the family wanted to be doing. Right. And so I founded an NGO called Freedom Now coming out of law school as an all-volunteer group for the first couple of years. And later, the organization hired its first full-time executive director. And I served on the board of the organization through 2018 when I stepped down. But the organization continues with its important work. And both through Freedom Now and on my own, over the course of my career, I've taken some 50 cases, you know, to the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, covering about 350 political prisoners. And I have found repeatedly that combining legal, political, and public relations advocacy work, even on some of the hardest cases in the world, you know, you can outmaneuver a dictator and compel them to release political prisoners when it's something that they don't want to actually do. I do have a day job. I'm an international human rights lawyer. My day job as well. I occasionally have to make a living. Almost all these cases are pro bono cases. But, you know, I worked at a global law firm, DLA Piper, and became a partner there in the government affairs practice. A lot of my paid work was in the field of human rights as well. But I left DLA Piper as a partner about a dozen years ago to start my own firm called Perseus Strategies, and continue to do both paid human rights work, pro bono human rights work, writing and teaching. I've taught a number of different semesters at three different law schools, Georgetown, UPenn, and University of Michigan. And so, you know, I now have my own firm, and, you know, we're able to do a mix of the paid work, the pro bono work, the writing and the teaching. I've got an amazing team around me, always an army of interns helping during the semester as well as over the summers, law students and undergrads. And we do work in a whole lot of different areas of in the field of human rights, including a lot of work in an emerging area of technology, neurotechnology and human rights, which I can talk more about. But all this kind of comes back to my experience, you know, meeting some extraordinary political dissidents in grad school, being persuaded to become a human rights lawyer from that, not really even knowing what that would mean, you know, having had the experience of freeing my first political prisoner while I was a law student, and having seen how meaningful that was, and ultimately developing a career to work in the field of human rights. So I do a lot of things other than work on political prisoner cases, but that's really the work that I'm best known for. And that's why I was referred to by the New York Times as the extractor for my work representing political prisoners around the world. Not to be confused with your local dentist, I would say.
Right, which is not my favorite, but this is my favorite. You know, Jared, I know you're a very, very busy person, so thank you so much for your time. But I love that it's in your DNA to be a public service. But, you know, while reading your stories and even like watching you on this video, I can just sense and see, you know, you're a person with clarity, determination, but also you're able to really have the art of persuasion. I think that's very important, right? I don't think we collectively, regardless of which field, especially in your field, can make a change if you don't have much of a buy-in. So really admire that about you and just your, you know, your persistence and your dedication to see it all through. I think that takes an immense amount of resilience and really empathy to really be able to see it till the end. And so thank you so much for what you do. Some of the people you worked with, and obviously some of them, and, you know, as a kid, I was a big fan of Aung San Suu Kyi, and my parents would always thought I would become a lawyer, but I didn't. I did robotics and public health, but it's sometimes still to speak like one. You work with Aung San Suu Kyi, you work with Liu Xiaobo, you work with many other amazing, you know, interestingly also, they are Nobel Prize winners who were imprisoned while fighting for the freedom of others, which to me, you know, when I think about it, I'm like, people are fighting for the freedom of others, and them being imprisoned is kind of this very painful duality experience for the people watching and for the people, you know, people in that position. And I think, you know, Jared, what you're doing is a privileged work of a lifetime, and it's so unique and such a precious thing you're doing. How did you feel, and what gives you courage when you walk through all these stories, and how do you manage the dualities?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's undoubtedly very, very hard work. It's although much harder, of course, to be the prisoner themselves or a member of their family, especially. You know, I think all that I can do is to help provide some clarity, which is a good word to use, for the families of victims as to how they can maximize the power of their own voice to have an impact that can actually help secure the release of their loved ones. You know, every case that I take on of a political prisoner is impossible at the beginning. And it's as Nelson Mandela said, you know, it always seems impossible until it's done. And because it seems so impossible, it's almost immobilizing, I think, for a family member who has never been through something like that before most of the time, in terms of what should they do? How should they pursue things? Do they go public or not? And what are the pros and cons of doing that? You know, not wanting to do any harm to their loved one, obviously, which is very, very important for people. And mostly people are just overwhelmed by the enormity of the challenge that they face. And I think that what I really try to do is to, having been through many of these cases before with my clients and across my 50 cases and about 350 prisoners I've gotten out, on average, the average prisoner served 11 and a half years less in jail than the time to which they were sentenced across all of my cases, which I think can provide some hope and clarity as well for families to say, you know, if you undergo this kind of a process, if you start down this road, and if you've tried to figure out what are the most effective things you can do to advocate for your loved one, you can actually have a real impact on it. But the key thing is not to think of it as like, you know, I have to climb Mount Everest on day one, right? Which if you told somebody, you know, in 24 hours, you have to go climb Mount Everest would be overwhelming and scary and impossible to imagine, right? But, you know, anyone who climbs Mount Everest has a long journey to get to even base camp, right? In terms of preparing themselves, you know, physically and psychologically for such a journey, practicing on other mountains, you know, and even as you're going up Mount Everest, getting to each base camp, acclimatizing and so forth. So I think that's a good analogy for the work of freeing a political prisoner in many respects, because, you know, oftentimes you just have to put one foot in front of the other and start walking down the road, right? You know, and in week one, it's like, okay, let's do a 2-page summary of everything you know that's happened, right? And then start to reach out to some core people, you know, and then after that, you start to think about, well, you know, what's the domestic legal process going to look like? Do we have a local lawyer? Can a local lawyer be hired, you know, to start to work with us, right? And, you know, and then we have to start to look at, you know, and over time, you look at the dictator themselves and what are they afraid of? Because, you know, inspiring fear in a dictator is how you make them change their behavior. And dictators are afraid of a lot of things. You know, they're afraid of loss of power, of justice and accountability, of sanctions being imposed against them and their families, of having their stolen money that they've taken be seized and grabbed and returned to the people of their own country. They're afraid of travel bans. You know, all of these things are things that worry them. And, you know, dictators don't ever release political prisoners because they want to. They do it when they have to and when it's the least worst choice of a lot of bad choices they have in front of them. And so you have to inspire fear in the dictator and you have to think through, well, how do I go about doing that most effectively? One of the other things is that, you know, a dictator has many things to worry about. Whereas if you're the family of a political prisoner, you're focusing on one thing, which is how do I highlight my loved one's case, you know, in the court of public opinion? And how do I advocate for them as effectively as possible through political and public relations advocacy? And with that kind of relentless focus and effort, you know, and getting on the road and going to different capitals and advocating for your loved one with the help of someone like myself and my team, you can actually have a big impact on people's personal interest in helping. You know, even in an era of Zoom that we are in post-COVID, or I guess still some COVID too, but there is still no substitute for showing up in person and meeting someone face-to-face and sitting in a room with somebody and asking for them to help. And that's been a really important part of the overall strategy of all the cases that I've worked on, is that, you know, yes, you have to fight the case at the UN. So the UN says a person is being held legally and calls for their release, but you also have to persuade individual people who are decision makers with governments, individual governments and multilateral institutions by showing up in person and asking for their help and pressing for them to help. And you need to put pressure on that government through political actions, the government detaining the person, and through media stories criticizing the government for detaining the person who you're trying to help and so forth. And so, you know, you really take this work, you know, one day, one week, one month at a time, right? And for a person who's never done this before, if you're talking about a family, for example, that has never had their loved one in prison before, and, you know, the goal is, okay, well, next we're going to do a trip to Washington, and who are the people we're going to meet? And then what are the talking points for each meeting? And how do we focus on each of those talking points? And that's a digestible piece that somebody, a reasonable person, can absorb and think through. It might provoke a lot of stress and anxiety, especially the first time you do it, because you don't know what to expect. But obviously, you know, my team and I are always there to help provide the support to a person so they can get through this. It's, you know, it's re-traumatizing for people to have to tell the story of their imprisoned loved one over and over and over again. And people need to be prepared and willing and able to do that, which is hard, very, very hard. And it's hard for me as the lawyer for someone to see a person struggle to do that. And yet that individual story has a big direct and big impact on people's willingness to help. So I think there's obviously lots more we could talk about all of this, but let me just stop there for now and just kind of say that, you know, every one of these cases is impossible at the beginning. And it's a question of how do you, you know, break down the path from where we are today to getting the person out, you know, into digestible chunks. And it's also always having the vision in your mind and never losing focus of that, of the day they're going to walk free, of what it will feel like, what it will be like, you know, what you will experience when either they're released in the country that they're in and stay there, or if they're going to have to go abroad, you know, having them released and meeting them abroad. And I think, you know, in many respects, you know, doing that visioning exercise and always returning to it as, you know, the only outcome that you can live with, which is, of course, the truth, the only outcome you can live with, is what enables you to, you know, when you're feeling down, when you're feeling like things are hopeless or where things aren't going as fast as you want with different things you're doing, you always try to return to that kind of very clear vision for why are you doing this and to what end, and to never lose sight of that. And, you know, in essence, you have to just outlast, you know, the dictator in question who's imprisoned the person because they are a real or imagined threat, right? And if you can escalate the costs of imprisoning that person dramatically above the benefits to the government detaining them, then, you know, most of these regimes, in my experience, are ultimately rational. And while they will not want to do it, and they'll only do it kicking and screaming, ultimately they'll cave if you can elevate the costs high enough, because they want other things more than keeping the person in jail. Now, of course, certain cases are even harder. Among the hard cases that you work on, Aung San Suu Kyi's case was one example. I represented her from 2006 to 2010 during that term of house arrest. She obviously later became a figure viewed very differently than she was back when I represented her. You know, I represented Anwar Ibrahim in Malaysia, who had, during his second term as a political prisoner. Today, he's the prime minister, you know, of Malaysia itself. But at the time he was a political prisoner, getting him out was quite hard because the dictator saw him as a direct political threat. And so there are obviously certain cases are harder or easier than others. None of them are easy or come quickly, although sometimes you can get lucky and have some things happen the right way in the process. But, you know, there is no substitute, as you suggest, for being relentless and determined, being resilient, and, you know, keeping a clear mind as to what you're going towards and how important it is for you to get there. And then just, you know, you have to just slog through it. I mean, you just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other, one day at a time, one week at a time, one month at a time, you know, and ultimately, you know, you have to just keep your mind focused on the fact that failure is not an option, and that you're going to create a reality where your loved one will walk out of jail.
You know, I'll take this as a personal advice for my own reasons, but I, you know, I see so much sense of hope. And I know this, as easier as it sounds to many of us over this audio, I know that there goes in a lot of pain and anxiety and trouble, even from your side.
You know, they tell you in law school, like in medical school, like, you know, you need to try to keep some distance from your clients emotionally, right? When you're working on a case or a cause. The reality is, as a human rights lawyer, that's just simply impossible. You can't do that. Now, that doesn't mean that I spend 24 hours a day crying over the plight of my clients. I have to function, right? So I am capable to some extent of doing that. But, you know, I cry with my clients all the time. It's just part of, you know, crying is a natural release of human emotion. And sometimes a good cry can be very helpful to kind of help you power through what you have to go through. You know, the situations are just brutal. I mean, when I've represented political prisoners, for example, you know, who have young children and their children are being kept from their, you know, from their parent. I mean, it's just so hard to see that. You know, when I've represented, you know, more recently in another case of two American hostages in Iran, there was a father and a son, Simak and Bahar Namazi, both taken from the same family. And for the brother, you know, the mother was inside Iran at the time, and the brother was the only family member abroad. And he had to carry the weight of both his father and brother on his back over many, many, many years to ultimately get them both out. And that's brutal. And so I guess each case comes with its own brutality. You know, I would say, as has often been said to me on political prisoner cases, you know, taking of a political prisoner is very much like the use of an anti-personnel landmine, where, you know, the regime or government or dictatorship in question is trying to spread as much damage as possible. You know, and anti-personnel landmines are not designed to kill people, but to take off their legs, for example, right? And that's traumatizing to the army that they're serving in. That's then traumatizing to their families who have to take care of them for the rest of their lives and help them recover, and the extended family that knows them, et cetera, right? You know, and the taking of a political prisoner has the same effect, because a political prisoner is a person who is fighting for human rights and democracy, whether it be as a journalist or as a dissident lawyer or a political leader or a civil society leader, right? And when they're taken as a political prisoner, you know, all of that work, all of those great efforts that they've undertaken in their lives and careers has to come to a halt, and to mobilize all the people around them to help secure the release of this one person, right? And the family is, you know, as much of a victim as the prisoner themselves, and often more so of the victim. And so I think that, you know, dealing with that emotional trauma is something you have to do with the family, you know, head on, right? You know, and there are times, of course, I'll recommend that, you know, my clients, family members should be in therapy, especially when you've got kids, you know, involved. The kids themselves especially need that kind of help and support to make it through and to understand. Because, I mean, you know, even for just a kid, if you think about it for a moment, whose loved one is, whose father, let's say, or mother is a political prisoner, you know, kids don't understand the difference between a political prisoner and a regular prisoner, right? And, you know, you'll have kids being made fun of because their father's in jail. And it's like, but their father's actually a hero because, you know, or their mother's a hero because they're a human rights defender, right? And so, you know, you have to help kids, you know, be resilient through these very difficult moments. You know, and I've had many a conversation with a kid or a child of a political prisoner of mine, where I've wanted to take the time to tell them that, you know, that their father, their mother, you know, is a hero of mine, and, you know, and why it's so important that they understand that, you know, their father and mother are in prison for something very good, not for something bad, you know, and that there's no reason to think anything negative about their parent because they love them and they're doing this for the sake of their own family, their communities, and their country. But it's hard for kids, especially in these circumstances. So I think that as a human rights lawyer, I would be doing a huge disservice to my clients and their families if I didn't acknowledge and meet them, you know, where they're at emotionally, because of the enormous and devastating impact of these kinds of cases on the loved ones of those who've been in prison.
This is so incredible. I could cry if I needed to, but I know I have to finish this interview.
I'll join you crying. I mean, I cry all the time. I cry at airport releases. I cry when I hear my clients are being tortured, you know, and I, as I've always said to the families of political prisoners, you know, crying is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. It means that you're able to feel something about what is going on, and it is moving you. And dictators, for the most part, in my experience, don't cry and can't cry because they're just so self-absorbed and self-interested, and they're so focused on wanting to inflict pain on others that, you know, they're, well, you know, typically narcissists and sociopaths, you know, who are so self-interested that they're not capable of having empathy for another human being.
But one, congratulations on Siamak Nabazi's release. And how do you feel, Jared?
Well, that I mean, Siamak, you know, spent almost 8 years in an Iranian jail as a hostage of Iran and was left behind originally by the Obama administration before I was involved in the case. I got involved later, but then was left behind twice more by the Trump administration and was only released as part of the overall hostage deal about 3 months ago now to get five Americans out of Iran. In exchange for unfreezing of Iranian money that was held in South Korea, $6 billion, which is a gigantic amount of money that was unfrozen. To be clear, it was, you know, Iran's own money that was theirs that they should have had the proceeds of many years earlier for an oil transaction with a number of South Korean companies. But it doesn't change the fact that it's an enormous amount of money that you know, will now go back to Iran in the form of payments for food and medicines. But getting him out was an enormous relief. I think more than feeling a sense of joy, I felt a sense of relief because, you know, it was about 1,900 pro bono hours of time to get him and his father, who had been Bahar Namazi, who had been a hostage of Iran for many years too, both of them out. And it came in the nick of time. Because, you know, given the connection back to Iran and the attack by Hamas on Israel on October 7th, if they had still been sitting in jail, given Iran's funding for Hamas and Iran's funding for Hezbollah, there would have been no scenario where President Biden would have been able to cut a deal to get the American hostages out of Iran. It wouldn't have happened. And all of them would have served at least their full sentences, if not longer. So, you know, they got very, very lucky to get out when they did. And Iran has become masterful at imprisoning. And I say this not as a compliment, but as a an observation of disgust at how effective they've been at taking hostages, foreign hostages, over the years and trading them for things of value. And it's one of the reasons why 2 years ago, I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying that, you know, the U.S. and other countries around the world have to take a very different approach to disincentivize hostage taking, because without draconian disincentives for taking of hostages and getting countries like the U.S. and other and its allies together multilaterally to create enormous disproportionate consequences for the taking of hostages, it will continue to be rational to take hostages. And Iran, you know, today, Iran and other countries around the world that take hostages like Russia or China, North Korea, you know, they see no negative effect of taking hostage, because other than criticism, most countries take no actual action in response to the taking of a hostage. And ultimately, although every country in the world, like the US and others that have had hostages taken, say they're not going to make a deal, you know, that it's deplorable what's been happening, and they'll condemn the hostage taking, ultimately, you know, we are consistently inconsistent in how we act, right? You know, we say we don't negotiate with terrorists, except then we do. We say we won't make policy concessions, except when we do, and so forth. And so it remains utterly rational for foreign, you know, rogue states to take hostages. And to change the practices, we need a new approach to creating these kinds of draconian disincentives, so that if a single hostage is taken from any country in the world, you have dozens of states acting together to disincentivize that behavior.
So are you saying there should be more of a standardization of how this is being approached across the US in terms of the policy, in terms of, you know, globally?
Yeah. So, I mean, what I propose is a multilateral agreement that the US and its allies might sign on to. Probably 50, 60 countries in the world would theoretically be willing to do this. And I actually prepared a draft of what that agreement should look like. And the idea is to use the Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, which in summary is an attack on one is an attack on all, to take that kind of principle and apply it in the context of hostage taking. And so the idea would be that every country that signs onto this multilateral agreement would say, if anyone was taken from any of our respective states, then we would consider it as if our own, you know, national was taken hostage. And then the idea would be, I've identified like 25 different potential actions that could be undertaken individually and collectively by states in response to a hostage taking. And I think that by having those be public and for rogue states to be aware of what they are, from the most minimal, simply condemning what happened, to the most maximal of, you know, every kind of sanction you can imagine. You know, I think that would be the kind of thing that could create those disincentives. The key thing would be, you know, the idea is that if any one national is taken hostage, that country could ask other signatories onto this agreement to say, we would like you to do action X, Y, Z in collaboration with us. No state could be forced to do something, obviously, it didn't want to do. But the idea would be that if a state asked for example, starting with a joint condemnation, there should be no reason why all 40 or 50 countries on the agreement couldn't condemn the taking of one hostage, right? And so it would create an incentive for collaboration and coordination across countries. And the other thing is that if, you know, you were to take an individual case that happened after this agreement came into force, and the kind of disincentives that I'm talking about were then imposed, all of a sudden the value proposition for taking the hostage in the first place would be totally turned upside down, right? The only reason why rogue states take foreigners hostage is because they have seen historically over decades no actual consequence other than condemnations if they undertake that behavior. And despite every state in the world that has hostages taken claiming publicly they won't make a deal, they're not going to negotiate, you know, at the end of the day, all of them make some kind of concession or set of concessions in order to get their hostages home, because over time, you know, the pressure on that government will increase from the family and from, you know, NGOs and from the media and so forth. And so saying we're not going to do any deal under any circumstance is just simply not a defensible position for a democracy to take. And so the only way that states will reevaluate, rogue states will reevaluate their willingness to take hostages, is if they see that the costs are now a lot higher than the benefits. But as long as the costs remain lower than the benefits, it's a natural and predictable and obvious decision for them to take, to grab more foreigners hostage, because there's no disincentive for doing it. And ultimately, while there'll be a lot of belly aching among the states whose nationals were taken, most states will ultimately cut a deal, right? And so it's like, if you can be guaranteed a positive outcome every time, then why would it not be natural for you to do it over and over and over again?
Why are they not doing it? Maybe that's a 5-hour conversation, but
yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I know that the Biden administration is working on this. You know, I had the opportunity to discuss this both with the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, and with the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, a while back now. But, you know, they both in general were in agreement with the kind of multilateral approach that I was mentioning. Obviously, this doesn't relate to political prisoners more broadly. This is a more narrow class of people who are detained for something of value, who are defined as hostages under the hostage-taking convention. I think a similar approach could also be undertaken, frankly, when it comes to the taking of political prisoners as well. There is more multilateral cooperation endemically in the taking of political prisoners, especially higher profile ones, because, you know, lots of people want to stand in support of somebody like an Anwar Ibrahim or an Aung San Suu Kyi back in better days, let's say before she became the current person she is today, but during her prior terms of detention. So I think you already have cooperation happening there. But if a foreigner is taken hostage, then most other countries in the world, their initial response is to say, well, that's really a problem for the country that they're a citizen of. And it's not our job to say anything or do anything because it's not our national, which is not an unreasonable first position to take. But this is why, in my view, we have to change that entire way of thinking by having this kind of a multilateral agreement when it comes to the taking of foreigners as hostages.
It makes sense to me, but I'm hoping it comes into action. But, you know, Jared, health is a human right. You and I know that. Everyone knows that. But we are in a healthcare crisis globally, whether it's mental health, whether it's isolation, whether it's, you know, antibiotic resistance. As a human rights lawyer, what changes do you wish to see in the U.S. and globally?
Well, I could write several books and dissertations.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. But I think, you know, from your seat, the reason I ask a very broad question is because you're seeing, you know, you're meeting people which, you know, no normal human being would get to meet. You're in situations where, you know, many of us will never get to see, but you're seeing health from a very different perspective, whether it's health, whether it's, you know, access to, you know, medication.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the right to health, of course, is enshrined in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. You know, it's much less widely subscribed as the Treaty on Civil and Political Rights. You know, the U.S., for example, is not a party to the ICESCR, to that treaty. There's also a difference in terms of that treaty, in terms of how the right to health is supposed to be implemented, you know, and which is a progressive realization of rights rather than a requirement that the right be immediately provided to every person in every country in the world that signs and ratifies the treaty. That is one problem, I think, with economic, social, and cultural rights is the concept of progressive realization, which gets interpreted in many different ways and in many different contexts. You know, I think health is a fundamental human right. And the question is then how do we go about delivering it for the peoples of the world? You know, if you don't have your health, you have nothing. I mean, you have no ability to get an education if you're not healthy. You have no ability to have a job and to hold down a job if you're not healthy. You have no ability to raise a family, you know, and to provide support to your family if you're not healthy and so forth. So I think the right to health is a prerequisite to the realization of many, many other rights. And obviously, you know, even in the United States and in other developed countries, you know, you see huge gaps between the have and have nots in our societies. You know, in the United States, if you're poor or elderly, there's nationalized healthcare for you through Medicaid and Medicare. But if you're middle class or lower middle class, you know, there's just massive gaps in where there's no coverage at all. And where in essence, a person who gets sick, you know, has to pay out of pocket enormous amounts of money and pay themselves down into bankruptcy before they're then eligible to get Medicaid. And, you know, while there are a number of countries in the world with nationalized systems that have more resources to be able to put into that, in most countries in the world today, you know, you're not entitled to any healthcare at all, even if your country has signed and ratified that treaty. So, you know, I don't have any easy solutions to, you know, to these problems. But what I can say is that, you know, is that we have to think about, you know, what are the most creative and effective solutions that can be deployed to help people. The reality is we all know that preventative care is worth a whole lot more in terms of just, you know, dollar for dollar spent, you know, outcomes. And, you know, and so, you know, one doesn't always need in most contexts, you know, a hospital, a specialist doctor and so forth. And with most diseases and most situations around the world, you know, getting children their childhood immunizations through with the help of organizations like UNICEF or national NGOs, having primary care places where even, you know, nurse practitioners or, you know, people who aren't even doctors can do most diagnoses of most people with most average medical problems, right? You know, and putting more money into that preventative healthcare, because obviously if you can treat a child with some kind of disease before it spins out to become something more serious, it's a lot cheaper than dealing with that if the child ends up getting some severe disease. There are also tons of preventable diseases in the world where we have cures for them and where they're not widely available. I think, you know, what happened during COVID is, you know, it was endemic of one of the major problems that we had around the world, you know, which is that, you know, wealthier countries in the world were, you know, making the vaccine and deploying it to their own citizens who were getting second, third, and fourth shots when most of the world had nothing at all. And I think that kind of gross inequality is just a clear violation of the right to health and, you know, and rights of access that should have been provided along with the resources to ensure that the COVID vaccine and COVID therapeutics be made available more widely. That remains a problem today. You know, even if COVID has burned its way through many populations, you know, people are still getting COVID and people, you know, people who want the vaccine should be able to get the vaccine anywhere in the world. And that simply isn't happening. And so I think that's just one very high profile example of the gap between the commitments of states in terms of progressive realization of rights and the implementation in practice. And so, you know, I think that we really do need leaders of companies and leaders of governments that put money into foreign assistance to prioritize the right to health and to provide, you know, and to have the fair access and equal access to the most basic provisions of healthcare that are necessary to survive. And I think, you know, the failures of the international community during COVID were, I mean, shocking and stunning in terms of just the profound inequality that existed around the world and where most countries and most contexts were simply had no vaccine or access to be able to get it, no access to therapeutics. And so basically, you were basically looking at herd immunity as the only option, which of course, you know, led to, you know, countless unnecessary deaths that could have been prevented if people had had access to vaccines and therapeutics. So, you know, again, I could talk a lot about this topic.
I think there's inequities everywhere, whether that's food we buy, the vaccinations we need to get, the preventive care we need to get, whether it's a gym membership, even that's internet. You know, I think what 30% of the world doesn't have access to internet, then what does telehealth do, right? So, yeah, I think it'll take us days if you try to cover the topic, forget even solving the problem, right? But Jared, apart from being an incredible human rights lawyer, you're very much into neurotechnology. Share with us a bit more.
Yeah. So for those who are not familiar with neurotechnologies, neurotechnology, when you hear that word, it's referring to technologies that use brain-computer interfaces. There are two types of interfaces. One is an interface that is inserted into your skull and requires, you know, brain surgery to have it implanted. And then there are also wearable caps and helmets and hats and, you know, and wristbands that can also capture and decode neural activity and neural data from your brain, from your central and peripheral nervous systems, and either decode that data to explain something that is going on with your brain activity, or potentially even write to your brain in order to make changes to your brain activity. The reading and decoding neurotechnologies are far ahead of the writing technologies in the same way, like with languages. You know, it's easier to learn how to speak than it is to write. But, you know, it's important to appreciate that, you know, a lot of things that people might think of as science fiction are actually already science today. And these are, you know, and neurotechnologies are going to have an enormous impact on humanity in a wide array of ways. They're going to enable us to, you know, today, for example, while we can diagnose many brain diseases, there are no cures to brain diseases. And neurotechnologies will ultimately help develop cures for brain diseases. You know, will also help with lots of other areas of health and wellness, you know, as well, and may even be able to result in, you know, enhancements to our brain activity, whether it be improvements in memory or other kinds of things as well. And so there'll be enormous health benefits, enormous economic benefits, you know, but at the same time, this technology can be misused or abused. And so I think that, you know, I got to know several years ago, a very impressive leading global expert on neurotechnology, a guy named Dr. Rafael Yuste, Y-U-S-T-E, at Columbia University. And he and I, after just a one-hour conversation with him, I realized that as a human rights lawyer, I had no idea what was coming when it came to emerging neurotechnologies. And I was both excited and scared by what I was learning. To give you one example, you know, mind reading technology is no longer science fiction. It's actually science. Only now, so far, with implantable brain-computer interfaces, which most people would not want. But there was a major story in the New York Times about 2 months ago about a researcher out at Stanford who was experimenting on a woman who, with her consent, of course, who had a stroke 30 years earlier and was totally nonverbal and unable to move or signal in any way at all. And with implantable brain-computer interfaces just inside of her skull on top of her brain, today, she can now communicate at about 30 or 40 words a minute using capturing her thoughts and translating those into text. And, you know, the brain-computer interfaces were also able to capture signals that were attempted to be sent from her brain to her facial muscles so that her facial muscles, you know, would make ordinarily the kind of, you know, changes that make in a conversation that any of us have. And so this researcher at Stanford, Edward Chang, created an avatar of her, which she's now using to communicate. And you can see on a screen an avatar of this woman, and the facial muscle movements are matching the signals that previously were being sent because her facial muscles were incapable of moving because of the stroke, are now being decoded and put into the avatar. And the words that she's speaking are coming from her decoded thoughts. And so that gives you a sense of kind of how extraordinary things are. My own view is that, you know, we will have, I mean, according to my colleague, Dr. Yuste, in the next 2 or 3 years, a wearable cap that could do some similar things like this, especially in decoding human thought. And while that might be a great benefit, for example, doing word processing, where you can imagine doing word processing by thinking the words and having them appear on the screen, you could also then imagine, you know, more terrifying scenarios where, you know, that kind of technology could be used to interrogate criminal suspects or political dissidents, for example, right? And where you'd be very concerned about the misuse or abuse of this technology. It turns out today there are already about 40 publicly available consumer neurotech products that are using wearable devices to capture primarily through EEG technology brain scans and are now already available for a wide array of purposes, including, for example, helping monitor your sleep and what level of sleep you're actually in. So that if you're trying to improve your sleep, you know, helping you focus on that. There's another device that helps you determine if your brain is in a meditative state. So if you're big into meditation, you could meditate for an hour with this device on and then see, you know, based on your brain waves, you know, how much of the time were you actually in the meditative state. There's one of these devices that you can train to help you fly a little helicopter drone based on your thoughts about where you want it to go, and it will fly where you want it to go, and so forth. But it turns out, you know, the Neural Rights Foundation, which is an NGO that we created to work on these issues, both the policy issues and the human rights issues, you know, we're completing a report that we'll publish in January that is looking at these 40 consumer neurotech devices. And we find in this report that there are a lot of serious challenges with the user agreements in terms of, you know, how much data is being downloaded and for what purpose can that data be put. You know, today you can only decode about 1% of what's in a person's brain scan. That will be at like 3 to 5% in the next few years. And so what it means is that, you know, when you're looking at downloading brain data, you know, while today's devices, consumer devices, are not at a very high resolution, we're seeing major advancements in wearable devices. So for example, a new device that was created by Kernel, the company Kernel, which is their Flow helmet, and is being used by software developers in essence, you know, can basically do the equivalent of like an MRI brain scan, but in a wearable device. And this is a huge development because although right now it's a business to business device that costs $50,000, when you've now been able to put that very high resolution device in a wearable, right? It's only a matter of time before competition, you know, and other market developments will enable that device to be available at a much, much less expensive price and enable much more deep and wide, you know, interpretation of brain data in ways that, you know, may be more horrifying to people. You know, for example, it's already the case in a very rudimentary way that if you're already in a person's brain and you connect something to the optical nerve that translates into brain signals what your eyes are seeing and then sends it to the optical cortex, you know, you could actually already see roughly, you know, on a screen what a person is seeing in front of them in their own eyes if you connect a device to decode something that's what's going through a person's optical nerve. With advances in generative AI, the ability to improve the quality of that is going to increase enormously in rapid order. There's an expectation you should be able to cure blindness or hearing or other kinds of things by bypassing existing systems that your body has, you know, and for example, there's already several researchers already working on curing blindness, where in essence, for a person who is blind, they're going to attach, you know, you'll be wearing like a camera, a high definition camera, which will then, you know, translate into the signal that your brain needs to interpret it, that kind of data, you know, bypass in essence your optical nerve, your eyes and your optical nerve, and go right into your visual cortex, you know, where then that can be decoded by your brain and you will be able to see, you know, not necessarily with the same level of crispness or clarity in the earlier years as, you know, you and I are seeing right now, but something like that going forward. So on the one hand, this is all very exciting. On the other hand, it is also very worrying. Right now, you know, billions of dollars a year are being invested in research by governments as well as by companies. You know, the Chinese government, for example, is putting $1 billion a year into neurotech research that is all being run through the Chinese military. The U.S., to be fair, is putting about $600 million a year through the Obama Brain Initiative, of which about a third of it is going into DARPA, which is the Defense Department's research arm, and the rest of it is going to the National Institutes of Health and to the National Science Foundation. But there's huge amounts of resources being invested into neurotechnologies, and extraordinary developments are already here and are going to proliferate. And it's only a matter of a very short period of time before neurotech will have its breakthrough moment, you know, like we've had recently with ChatGPT in AI. And for me, I think that breakthrough moment will be when you have a wearable cap that can decode your thoughts at a very high level of accuracy. You know, the best implantable devices now can decode your thoughts at 94% accuracy. When you can approximate that with a wearable device, all of a sudden, I think people will see both the excitement around neurotechnologies and also the risk of misuse and abuse at the same time. And I think that that's going to attract enormous global attention. The last thing I'll just note is that, we're working on these issues at the United Nations and with national governments and other multilateral institutions to try to educate people about how quickly the technology is coming, where it is at, where it's heading, but then also what are the right kinds of global governance frameworks that need to be put in place and what needs to be done at a national level to protect, what we've identified as, five areas of risk associated with this technology. One is the need for a right of mental privacy and to protect what's obviously in your own neural data. A second relates to a right of mental identity and controlling your own identity and who you are. A third relates to a right of free will or mental agency. A fourth relates to the right to having a right of non-discrimination and bias in how these technologies are developed and how they're applied. And a final and a fifth one relates to a right to ultimately fair access to mental augmentation, as mental augmentation will inevitably become available. Now, a number of these kinds of concerns are addressed already by existing human rights, and some of them can be addressed by extending the interpretation of existing human rights to cover these kinds of concerns. Some may require, new areas of international law to be developed. But what we're saying to multilateral institutions and governments and NGOs and the media all around the world, as much as we can, is, the future is here now. And when you look at the consumer neurotech products that are already publicly available, that for the most part don't adhere to international standards around the protection of privacy rights and data, one should be concerned about our ability to handle the much more sophisticated devices, which are, well on their way to being available more broadly.
It's so fascinating and scary, because as you're speaking, I was thinking about, where can this be implemented in a healthcare setting, right? It could be with someone with a coma. It could be someone who's far away, someone who can't speak, someone who's, old in a ventilator where they just need to express to their loved ones at the last moment of time. So, I think, like you just mentioned, as long as it's governance, ethics, and really technology being created for the right reasons, with the right intent, which not always is the case, then we are, in a good setting. Given the crisis that is taking place in Gaza, what is a ray of hope do you feel and you would like to share for the future of humanity?
Well, I guess what I would say is, as many have said before me, that the problems of the world that we all face are problems that have been made by people. And therefore, if we're dumb enough to create the problem, we should be smart enough to be able to fix the problem. And I'm not speaking of Gaza specifically, but I'm speaking, yes, much more widely, in terms of what's happening in the world. And, I think at the end of the day, for me, what inspires me are these extraordinary human rights defenders who I've gotten to know over the course of my life and career, who are risking their lives to make their countries better for themselves, for their families, and for their communities. And despite all the reasons, to not engage in that fight, or to simply live a comfortable life abroad, or to stay in their own country and just stay quiet, right? There are always courageous humans who are prepared to risk their lives to for the sake of justice and for the sake of human dignity. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think, we're looking right now, 75 years after the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was just celebrated a few days ago, and one of the most profound aspects of the Universal Declaration when it was adopted, that it says that all humans are born free and equal in dignity and in rights. And I think that to me, that's really the touchstone of the modern human rights movement that resulted in then some 10 international human rights treaties being created to codify the aspirational and inspirational rights identified in the Universal Declaration. And I think international human rights law does provide a lot of clear guidance as to how do we handle and deal with these different kinds of situations. And, the real, the challenge of the 20th century was creating these rights in, binding legal instruments. And the challenge of the 21st century is closing the gap between the commitments of states to adhere to these rights and what is actually happening on the ground in countries all around the world in practice. And, obviously there's there's always a gap between the commitments and the implementation, sometimes small, sometimes gigantic, but there is a consensus in general around what the rights are and what they should be and how humans should be treated and how we should treat one another. And so I think in that sense, we no longer being in a position, although some people will still try to have a debate over, how people are treated. As an international human rights lawyer, my touchstone is the Universal Declaration and the international law that emanated from it, right? And And I can't think of any major problem that the world is facing right now that isn't addressed directly or indirectly in some way by our existing international human rights legal framework. And when it comes to how do we address problems, whether it be climate change or, you know, emerging technologies or food insecurity, you know, or you name it, right? You know, there's international law that's directly on point to those questions about how the world should be handling those kinds of issues and what people, individual people around the world should expect in terms of their rights. And that doesn't mean that we can immediately provide that for everybody in the world, but it does provide clarity around what should be expected and what should be demanded by the individual peoples of the world, and what should be expected in terms of what rich countries should be able to provide, you know, for their own people, but also provide for poor people in other countries around the world, you know, and then, and whatever, you know, every country in the world has something to contribute, obviously, to their own people's development and to global development as well, which is well captured, I think, in the Sustainable Development Goals. But, you know, there's still a huge gap between the commitments of the 2030 agenda originally and where we are and how we're going to come short of them. And I think that as a global community, we need to come together, find the resources to fund these critical efforts and not lose sight of, you know, why we're all here. And I don't think we're all here to just, you know, benefit ourselves and have our limited time on Earth, you know, for the sake of our own self-improvement. You know, I think that we're here to try to leave the world a little bit better off than how we found it. And there are many ways in which we can do that and many tools that we can employ as well. And, you know, there are always going to be obstacles and challenges. There are always going to be people that stand in the way. There are always going to be dictators that want to steal their people's resources for their own benefit. These are all things that one should expect, you know, which is the worst of humanity. But at the same time, we've all seen what happens when peoples come together and act in the spirit of the best of humanity. You know, when we come together, you know, in natural disasters or to respond to mass atrocity crimes or to come together to create new solutions to address problems like climate change. You know, we humans can do enormous and unrelenting damage, or we can do great good, you know, and I think each of us individually and all of us as a species have to decide the kind of world that we want to live in. My own view is that we can inspire people to their better selves. There are a million obstacles to do it, but in the work that I've seen all around the world and all the people that I've gotten to know and work with, you know, who are standing up to dictatorships around the world most especially, and who have inspired me the most, you know, it just reaffirms for me that ordinary people and any average person can do extraordinary things if they just simply set their mind to it. And you don't have to have had the best education or the best background or have gone to the best schools or any schools for that matter. You simply have to have a sense of your own humanity and of your own dignity, and to value every person as being equal, as the Universal Declaration says, in dignity and in rights, right? And figure out what you can do to help your neighbor and to help your street and to help your community to leave the world a little better off than how you found it. Everybody can help. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. said everybody can be great because everybody can serve. Undoubtedly, that's true. You know, there's so many things that divide us and so many people and institutions that try to divide us. But, you know, it's up to us individually to decide whether or not, you know, we want to work for a collective whole or whether we want to just be there for our own tribe. And to me, in light of the enormity of the challenges that we're facing, of all the kinds we've discussed here and many more, you know, tribalism is not a long-term solution to anyone's problems. It's not going to work. There are too many tribes and too many different peoples. And while it is contrary to people's initial inclinations, I think often to think about helping a collective rather than helping yourself and your family and your own people. You know, again, people, there are plenty of examples all around the world today and in history where people are doing just that and helping others. And so, I don't know. I mean, as a human rights lawyer, I try to do my part to leave the world a little better off. I try to help extraordinary people return to their important work, you know, when they're commitment and their courage put them in harm's way. That's sort of the part that I like to play in my narrow part of the world. But there's lots that anybody listening or anybody, you know, anybody in any community can do to just help in their own neighborhood, you know, try to make their neighborhood a little bit better, a little bit safer, a little bit more caring of its children and so forth. So, you know, I don't have any immediate solutions. I just try to, you know, gigantic or global or macro solutions. I try to do my part and try to spread that feeling and that spirit wherever I can and just keep, you know, trying to give back to society however I can too. And I think that's about all any of us can ever hope to do.
Yeah, Jared, I think you're doing incredible work, and I think you're being very humble. And I often recollect there are finite beings in the infinite world, and you know, there's no necessity to have greed and selfishness and division, because we're all going to die, you know, and the life is short, more than we think it is. And you know, a couple of months back, I was at a lunch with one of my close friends, and she said, "Simi, do you know Ichigo Ichigai?" And I said, "No, what is it?" She said, "This moment, this conversation, this expression of ours, no matter how many times we'll meet, maybe we'll never meet again, but it would never be repeated." And I so much feel that having you on this podcast today, that this moment, this story, this passion, this expression, yeah, hopefully we'll meet many more times, but this moment is so precious to me, Jared. And one of your favorite quotes is, "I know I can't save all my clients, and I've learned that every case is a profound failure until I succeed." This just goes who you are and gives us so much hope, gives me so much hope, you know, in humanity for having people like you. So much, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for being a part of Health Forward. Thank you so much for everything you do.
Yeah, well, thanks so much to me, and great to be with you. And I'm sure this won't be the last time, but I take the spirit with which you're speaking about it. And it's definitely, that's my life as well, as I travel the world, going to countries where human rights abuses are taking place. I meet lots of victims and people persevering and becoming advocates, having originally been victims and becoming stronger and more powerful and more impactful in their voice. All it takes is everyone deciding they want to do things a little bit differently and a little bit better. And if all of humanity were able to do that at the same time, well, we'd be in a very different place tomorrow than we were today. And the reality is, I think we can do all of that. It's just a question of persevering through the cynicism and through all of the forces in our societies that want to divide us and benefit from dividing us. But at the end of the day, I mean, as you say, I mean, you know, as the Bible says also, from ashes to ashes and dust to dust. I mean, we, you know, we all came from nothing and are going to return to nothing one day. And as you say, I mean, there's no need for human greed. You can't take anything with you. So the question is, what do you, you know, if the sum total of all of our collective acts is, you know, being buried by our loved ones, not to be too grim about it, but that's everyone's reality. Then the question is not, what have you made for yourself or your family? The question is, what have you given back, and how are you going to be remembered? And people live on who have done great good or who've done great evil. They live on. And what kind of legacy do each of us want to have for our children and our grandchildren and for our families and our communities? And I think there's just so much that everyone can do, and we all have to do our part.
Wonderfully said, Jared. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thank you. Great talking to you.
Thank you for listening. This is Health Forward Podcast, and I'm your host, Smriti Kirbanandi.